Welcome to Fill the Gap, the official podcast series of the CMT Association, hosted by David Lundgren and Tyler Wood. This monthly podcast will bring veteran market analysts and money managers into conversations that will explore the interviewee's investment philosophy, their process, and decision-making tools. By learning more about their key mentors, early influences, and their long careers in financial services, Fill the Gap will highlight lessons our guests have learned over many decades and multiple market cycles. Join us in conversation with the men and women of Wall Street who discovered, engineered, and refined the discipline of technical market analysis.
Fill the Gap is brought to you with support from Optima, a professional charting and data analytics platform. Whether you're a professional analyst, portfolio manager, or trader, Optima provides advanced technical and quantitative software to help you discover financial opportunities. Candidates in the CMT program gain free access to these powerful tools during the course of their study. Learn more at optima.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 37 of Fill the Gap, the official podcast of the CMT Association. My name is Tyler Wood. I'm a CMT charter holder, and joined with me as always is my dear friend and mentor, Dave Lundgren, CFA CMT. How are you doing, my friend?
Doing outstanding. How you doing, Tyler?
It's great to, every day that I wake up above ground is a blessing, yeah, Dave.
Right side of the grass.
Today, I'm more thankful than ever. This month, we are bringing all of the listeners a live in-studio recording of one of the best discussions I've seen from some of the most legendary technical analysts. This came from our February 1st midwinter retreat at the Tampa Club in Tampa, Florida. Huge thanks to Eric Case, a fresh board member for the CMT Association, for putting a ton of effort into revitalizing and bringing back this tradition of the midwinter retreat. Dave, did you ever go to the midwinter retreats back in the day?
You know, I have never been, but I was always very disappointed that I did not go back in the day. So I was very thankful that we brought it back. And having now gone to one, I can see why it was so popular. I mean, it was spectacular on many levels.
Yeah. You know, the CMT Association conferences over the last decade in New York City, hosting the symposium and growing larger and larger every year. The 50th anniversary in April, hosting over 400 participants over 3 days. It was a spectacle, and it was an amazing experience. It was also exhausting. and it was Bill Kelleher who brought this idea that, for years, the tradition was to run a seminar in New York for all the Wall Street and Boston folks, but to also get together in a slightly less formal environment, to bring good friends together to talk perhaps in a more casual and comfortable setting. And that was a tradition for decades. It actually ended in 2008. I have no idea why, Dave. there were a few things that changed after the great financial crisis, but it was a great chance for the community to come together, oftentimes bringing their family and just to sit together and try to solve this puzzle that we're all working on in the markets. So, Dave, the panel discussion that we're going to feature on this month's live recording for Fill the Gap was between some of the greatest legends. Talk to us a little bit about the panelists and how excited you are to hear this next session.
Yeah, no, for me, it was I was so excited to be there because, as always, whenever you get a chance to listen to Walt Diemer and Bob Farrell talk about the markets, their process, their experience, their wisdom. I mean, it's just something that you can never overvalue. It's always a great opportunity to have that. But for me in particular, the moderator of that panel was, of course, Frank Texaro, who is not just a very good friend of mine and my former boss at Wellington, but I also consider him to be one of my most important mentors in my career. And so to be able to, and the link there is that Bob Farrell is the one who brought Frank into the business. So it was kind of like a lineage. What's the word I'm looking for?
Genealogy.
Genealogy.
Yeah, the family tree. Yeah,
family tree. Yeah, and to be able to see and to listen and watch that conversation was just a really special moment, and it's also to see the crowd of folks that were there, really literally sitting on the edge of their seats taking notes, and it was really wonderful.
You know, it's important to point out, Dave, we were finishing up this panel discussion as Meta, Amazon, Tesla, and I forget who else was announcing. Apple were announcing earnings, and not a phone in sight. Nobody was checking the markets because there was just so much value being shared from the stage.
Yeah.
And I hope for everybody who's listening to this, you can understand that we are enjoying the fruits of a 50-year trend from bottom left to upper right for the discipline of technical analysis, for the craft and the tools that we can all use, but also how the industry perceives what professional technical analysts can provide. And Walt and Bob both gave a really tremendous insight into how much the industry has changed and the perception of technical analysis, largely because this community is shown the professionalism and the excellence and the competence that we all hold so dear. So without any further delay, welcome to episode 37 of Fill the Gap, the official podcast of the CMT Association, with Robert J. Farrell, Walter Diemer, moderated by Frank Teixeira, CMT CFA.
It is a real great job that I have, probably the best job anybody could ever ask for, which is to bring this community together to learn from the masters. I feel like a lot of entrants to the markets make a lot of bad, dumb mistakes. Anybody here make a dumb mistake ever in your career? Okay, so that is 100% of the audience.
And the people on the stage.
at CMT Association, we believe that by learning from the giants, the folks who've spent their lives trying to figure this out, we might avoid some of those same pitfalls. And never is the case more true than when you have generation after generation. Does everybody know who Frank Teixeira is? Right? He's pretty incredible. Yeah. When we asked Frank if he would moderate a discussion at the symposium with his mentor, Bob Farrell, this is a man I've never seen speechless before in my life, and somehow he had no words. And so we're actually stepping up the game even further, which is to bring two close colleagues from the '60s, Walter Diemer and Mr. Bob Farrell, and Frank is going to lead us through a discussion. We're gonna learn from the best about some of these tried and true methods that still hold resonance today. So, Frank, I'm going to let you take it away. It's such a great honor to have all of you gentlemen here with us. Thank you very much, and welcome.
Thanks for inviting us.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone, and I can't express what a thrill and a privilege this really is to be here. To say that we're sitting here with two walking encyclopedias of market history, contrary thinking, human nature, you name it, they have it. So if you really, really want to listen, I would suggest you lean forward, turn your ear this way, just like that, and pay attention, pay close attention. There's a lot of wisdom that's going to come out of here. But before we do that, Walter, I'm going to do this for you. There is some housekeeping that needs to happen this second. Apple's reporting, Amazon's reporting, Meta's reporting. Can anybody shout out what that looks like? Because he doesn't want anybody really super distracted while we're talking about the markets today, the past, the present, and the future. What do you got?
Amazon beat on the top and bottom line.
And the stock is?
We need that.
I just got
sub 3%.
Sub 3%. Okay. Anybody else got Apple yet? No. Well, Tyler, we're going to leave us. Tyler, we're going to leave this to you. You know when to step in and say, okay, I've got, hey, listen, I've got the news that everybody's been waiting for, all right, because right now we're going to talk markets. So I spent the past couple of hours with Bob and Walter. I've never had the privilege of spending, frankly, any time with Walter. I've seen him one time before at a CMT conference. I think you made a comment to me that I didn't really recall about Facebook breaking out. It was called Facebook, now it's called Meta. And you mentioned it, and I appreciate you even remembering that. So here we are today, and over the past 2 hours, Walter reminded me that Bob is the first president of the CMT, formerly known as the MTA. There's Bob here. And Walter was the seventh president.
Sixth?
Sixth? All right, sixth. All right, I wasn't listening as carefully as I thought. All right, sixth. And he said the way that we should remember it is that Bob is the George Washington of the CMT, and he is the John Quincy Adams of the CMT, and that nobody knows who John Quincy Adams is, all right? So, and then after that, we went in through a line of dad jokes, too, so we can share some of those later on. Anyway, so let's start with a couple of things. In terms of, I think what I'd like to go to the beginning. So I know that some of you have probably heard Bob share some of this, but to have Walter here and his perspective on the early days, I think is really fascinating. So I'm going to let Bob take it away. Tell us what it was like in the early days of being a technician. We could all speculate, but it's always nice to hear it from Bob.
Thanks, Frank. And it's nice to be here. And I hope we can say something that warrants the credit you give us for being legends. What I'd like to start with is the 1960s, which was where the Market Technicians Association was born, and or this chartered market technicians. My way of introducing this is to tell you how I was worked with Merrill Lynch. I became the technician for Merrill Lynch in 1959, and I got the job because nobody else wanted it, and I was a trainee, and I knew nothing about technical analysis, and that tells you how highly technical analysis was regarded at Merrill Lynch. And in fact, the founder of the company, Charles Merrill, said, "We will never publish a market comment." And as I went on in time, in 1961, Merrill Lynch ran an ad that said, "Okay, Charlie, put those charts away." So that's how much they regarded it. Although by 1968, they ran an ad with my picture in it, me looking at some charts and telling people how important I was to them. Now, another thing that happened in that regard was that Merrill Lynch never sold any mutual funds until 1968, which of course was a good indicator of a market nearing a top. Then we started to sell mutual funds. But the main point is about the 1960s. I know it's not something you're here to hear a whole lot about, and I won't go on, but it was a time of real change. And the change that I'm referring to is not just that it was a last stages of a long bull market with a lot of speculation at the end in the go-go 60s, but it was also a time when the individual investor became less a factor and institutional investing was increasing in a big time. Mutual funds were really coming on strong. And in this idea of markets changing, that was important for us as technicians to recognize that our market wasn't just the individual trader for short-term gains. Our market should be, what can we do to help the longer-term institutional investor? How can we help him time and select stocks with long-term potential? And that was something that I concentrated on early, but a lot of the technicians at the time began to realize that that was our future. And I think the occurrence of, well, the putting together of the market technicians was society, or as we were. I get that mixed up with all our different terminologies. But I think in 1968, when we were in the midst of a very big speculative period and the institutions were not only the mutual funds, but also the major banks had their big trading desks, and I mean everything was changing at the time. And fortunately, there were three young guys, Ralph Alcampora and John Brooks and John Greeley, that called a meeting of the technicians who had the highest visibility at the time. That included Alan Shaw, and we do miss him. He was a great technician, a great guy. But there were 18 of us, and we all got in a room, and Ralph and the two Johns made this proposal. Why don't we get together and have something that's similar to the New York Society of Security Analysts? And that was the beginning. We all decided that's the right thing to do. And they came to me and asked me to be the first president. And I feel that was probably because I had the biggest platform in the largest brokerage firm at the time. But that was the evolution of it. Now, Walter here has also worked with me in 1964 through 1966. And Walter has had the experience of working with a leading mutual funds. And the first one he worked for was Manhattan Fund. And I'd like to give Walter a chance to say a few things about his experience with Jerry Tsai, the high priestess of growth investing in the 1960s.
Hi, thanks. When you said about making mistakes, when I started in the business, I figured that what I should do is, every time I made a mistake, vow never to make it again. And in time, I would run out of mistakes. In 60 years and I ain't run out yet. That's the problem. But the MTA started, it was originally the Market Technicians Association of New York. And Bill Doan from Fidelity and Bill Diani from Wellington Putnam were doing all the work, because we were on the buy side. The sell side people had to earn a living. So Bill Diani did the quarterly journal, and Bill Doan did the newsletter, and I ran the membership thing. And so we got mad one day, and we said, why they call it the Market Technicians Association of New York? So we asked them to drop New York out of the name. And that was the first big fight at the MTA. There have been a number of them since, but that was the first one. But I left the greener pastures of New York, of Maryland. I started working for Bob Farrell, knowing it all. And year by year, I realized how little what little I knew. So you start off headstrong, and then you get into the real world. Jerry Tsai was starting the Manhattan Fund, which is the go-go years back for you youngins. It was a big speculative binge in 1968 and 1968-9. The paperwork barrage was so much, the New York Stock Exchange had to close on Wednesdays. I asked Jerry whether I could take Wednesday off since the market was closed. He said no. And the American Stock Exchange tape was at one point running 37 minutes late. And the American Stock Exchange, you know, before it finally died, was not moving at all. But there were all sorts of speculative excesses. Every, I guess, bull market has a speculative excess, and this was the speculative excess of the bull market of the 1960s, the go-go years, where all sorts of shenanigans were going on. And I was fortunate, because having moved over to the buy side, every technician in the universe came in to see Jerry. So I got to see them all. And some of them, Jerry would come back from lunch with a paper napkin with some chart drawn on it that he had lunch with. I met some very good people. I met some very strange people. That's basically how it started. It was a wild time, and it ended with the end of the speculative boom.
That's great. That's a great story. I'm going to share something only because I want to interject before we continue on. By the way, I've taken a lot of notes from my day, and they're all in script. We actually talked about how nobody can read script anymore. This is the hieroglyphics of the future, in case you know. So keep it up in case you're needed. 20 years down the road. I started at Merrill in 1991. I'm going to tell you a little story about. I've shared this at the symposium, but I think it's worth sharing again. I don't know how many people were here for the 50th. Were in New York for the 50th, but I was at the New York Stock Exchange working in compliance for 2 years. After I left the New York Stock Exchange, I ended up in the marketing department at Merrill, but I was really impassioned by technicals, that kind of thing. I went to the morning meeting one day, and on Mondays, the meeting was always led by Bob with the technical comment. Well, as fate would have it, the one Monday that I got in late, he was already midstream, and I didn't know Bob. I couldn't pick him out of a lineup at the time, you know, and I'm listening, and I was like, wow, this is really fascinating stuff. I couldn't stop writing it all down. And I went back to the marketing department, and they said, hey, what'd you think of, Bob's comments? I was like, that was Bob? I was like, oh my God. He speaks every Monday. You should go to that. Yeah. Next Monday, I went, and I was there early, first one in the room, so I wasn't going to miss this opportunity. When he was done, I got up. I stalked him all the way down one hallway, around another hallway, down into the, and I in the elevator, I introduced myself to Bob. So, and he gave me 2 or 3 minutes, and he said, it's a nice meeting. If you want to come to our meetings, we have a meeting every Monday after the morning meeting. And I was like, yeah, you sure? He goes, yeah, why don't you come? I was like, are you going to be there? So that's how it started. I went to his meetings every Monday. A few months later, he hired me. Long story short, 6 years at Merrill, 22 years at Wellington Management. Not only in those 6 years did Bob shape the way I think about investing, but he shaped the way I think about the way I speak, the way I carry myself. There's a lot of stories there. And he's the way you think about family, the way you think about work, life. He was work-life balance before work-life balance was a thing, you know, and I owe him so much for where I am today, and I just wanted to get that out in front of this audience and express my appreciation for those wonderful years at Merrill Lynch.
Frank, quick interruption.
Please.
$5.
He knows the story very well. We can tell that one later, but I want, again, it's not about me.
I thought that was Apple's earnings.
So Apple is up $5?
Yeah,
$5. Okay. A long story, a short story, but a long story. All right, so let's move on here. So Bob has made some comments recently about the great transition and things evolving within the marketplace and possible new revolution, the AI revolution. Through the lens of history, there have been many revolutions. How do you view what's going on now in the context of history?
Well, once again, and I made a really good selection when I hired Frank, one of the outstanding people, and I've had a chance to hire many qualified and unusual people, and I made a point, generally, of not hiring people who went to Ivy League schools, because they were all going into investment banking, and I wanted hungry young guys that had a lot of moxie and were already interested in the business and weren't coming here to say, I'm here and I'm going to make your life better. They came more humbly, and that's great for me and for them. But in any event, on the changes that are happening, I mean, I'm looking at, I mean, when I started into the business, I had a mentor. My mentor's name was William Duncak, and he had been the head of research for Merrill Lynch for 25 years, and he was a fundamentalist, but he knew markets, and he knew stocks, and he was the complete package. And I was in only the first year of being the technician, knowing nothing except reading books about technical analysis and learning what it was about. And he asked me to join him when he left research to go up on the staff of the president of the company as the market economist. And he was kind of kicked upstairs because he wasn't as sales-oriented as some of the people in sales wanted, but he was really a great person to study under. I had 4 years with him where he taught me about the psychology infecting how it affects markets and how we could really tap into that with the big sample we had at Merrill, which was margin trading, short sale data, stop loss data. You know, it was the beginning of the sentiment indicators that everybody talks about today, and that's what we named it. And sentiment is one part of the equation, because I felt when I came into this business that the smartest people in the country will go to Wall Street because that's where the money is. And I wasn't that smart. But that's quantitative smarts versus street smarts, or left brain versus right brain. And I capitalized on the right brain part, or the people part, because markets are made by people, and people's emotions are what makes things extreme. Why people sell more at bottoms and buy more at tops. And what the changes that were that evolved over time that I was most impressed by as we went on, I was able to have publish a market comment in 1971, and Merrill Lynch had said back in 1928, we're never going to publish a market comment. And I had to go through 7 years of internally presenting my market comment with all kinds of caution causes, including burn before reading. But we wound up. That was an introduction to 1967 that the first issue of the Institutional Investor magazine was published. And by 1971, they started having an all-American team rating of analysts, mostly all fundamentalists. And it wasn't until 1976 that they recognized a technical category. And that continued on, but it was something that shows you how long it took us to establish ourselves as making a contribution to this whole process of investing for profit. And in the process, one of the things that happened that really was something you wouldn't expect, that Merrill Lynch in 1966 commissioned a study with Stanford University on instant charting through using a computer to get the data out and on paper or available quickly, like the stuff that we get today that's in Bloomberg in the more sophisticated form. And they took it to its really ultimate form that was useful for the institutional world and trading. But I think that from the standpoint, and that's a surprise because of the ads I told you about them and the attitude toward charting, but technical analysis, as we looked at, I thought technical analysis was something that people looked down on, that it was just a, you know, we were called elves and called all kinds of things, sorcerers, and it was not my aim was to try to make out of what we do something that was recognized in the investment world, and part of that was to have some dignity to it. Mm-hmm. You know, Joe Granville was one of the first people who achieved recognition as a technician. He wrote a great book about daily market timing. And Joe was a smart guy, but he was kind of a little flaky. I mean, he gave one talk up in Minnesota where he mooned the audience. So that didn't help the regard from which technicians were held. But to me, one of the most important things that happened after that, not after he mooned, but it was in 1984, the Investor's Business Daily started publishing. And that combined charts and information on fundamentals along together. And, you know, and for so long it had been like us versus them. If you either were a technician and you could look at a chart, or you could say it's oversold, or and what I really did feel in trying to communicate to people was be simple. And so I had, even in when I was addressing mostly institutional investors, I would talk about things like saucers are bullish and umbrellas are bearish. And that still applies today. And looking at what the combination that Bill O'Neill put together in that newspaper, I thought that was one of the great contributions to our investment universe, or all of us in this business. And it's still going today, even though we lost Bill recently. But in getting into the change as we went on, you know, the various steps that were being taken, the Investment Business Daily was one of them. But when we got to the turn of the century, you know, at one time you just looked at a ticker tape to find out what was happening on the New York Stock Exchange. And now, and we still see that on the TV tubes, but it was, we got to the point in 2001 where they changed to decimalization. And that way enabled, because we were trading in eighths and quarters and sometimes greater intervals. And this was the change that enabled the computerization to take place, and that happened in 2003 when they did away with basically the specialist system. And then we had a very unique event that happened in 2007 where a uptick rule on short sales was eliminated. And it had been in effect for 70 years. And there was no reason given for it being eliminated other than it did enable algorithmic trading to start, or not to start, but it gave it more options. And algorithmic trading now has been another one of the big changes that we have, which is affecting stock price behavior, but it's all for fractions of pennies and in huge volumes to create some value for the people who were writing these programs. And these three events, to me, have made a change in the way markets are acting, to the point where I think we do see some periods where what looks like an obvious bullish breakout fails after a short follow-through, or a breakdown fails after and doesn't follow through on the downside, where it might be a wiping out of stop loss orders. But these programs are the first stage, this algorithmic trading, it seems to me, and I'm not an expert in it at all, but that's the first step toward of this computer revolution that we've been in and going on for some time. And it's now called artificial intelligence. And we don't know what the answers will be to the artificial intelligence impact, but I do think that we'll see changes and be forced into interpreting some of the data that we see a little differently. It's like today, if the volume in the stock exchange is 60 or 70% of the total volume is algorithmic trading generated, then how can we be sure what we're seeing when we look at volume on charts, that it is true buying or true selling, and other than somebody looking for a quick turn? But we're as we go ahead, you know, I'm thinking of maybe the artificial intelligence will have the same kind of reaction to it that we've had in the past, which is each new step in technology, like let's say RCA was a big deal and a big technological change, Radio Corporation of America, in the late 1920s. And RCA went up 200% in the last 3 years of the 20s into 1929. And it illustrated how it is in the anticipation of a new technology's great potential that you see the greatest move in the stock market. And then it takes some time to adjust and really get the profits that promised. And in the between, the stock performance, like in RCA, it went down after going up 200%. It went down 98% into 1932. And if you were a buyer at the 2029 top, you didn't get your money back until 1986 when GE bought them. And there, it's the same thing that happened with the internet boom. We had all the big speculation and all the gains were happening early before the real profitability, some of the profitability was showing, but the big picture profitability really came much later. And that showed up with another parabolic move in all of these stocks that are associated with the internet and the whole picture in the computer industry. And I think from what we saw in 2000 with the topping of that boom, and they fell out of favor for about 10 years, but the good ones like Microsoft to come back and have a whole new cycle. Mm-hmm. So in any event, I think we're going to see, and we are seeing, many changes that are affecting how we will interpret the whole idea of, you know, what are people, can AI duplicate what individuals are thinking? You know, we say that's true, but the emotional part is the hard part for, I think, that to happen. The emotion is what creates the extremes. We get fear and greed as being the major factors in affecting how we think and how markets act. So those kinds of things are something to be keeping in mind. And I'd like to talk about some other things, but I want to give Walter a chance.
Yeah, I want to bring Walter into the conversation too, because I know you're both fairly big proponents of the impact of human nature on the performance of the of stocks and the markets. And Walter, you also ran the research department, technical research department at Putnam for 10 years. I think there's a unique perspective that you can offer here. There's not many of us who've done that. I'd like to hand you the mic and see if you can share some things with us.
Okay, well, things that have changed. I think technical analysis at some point evolved from being a very short-term oriented approach to institutions realizing it could help with longer-term trends. And so it became institutionalized. It was used. I was a member of Putnam's policy committee, investment policy committee. I helped set the policy for long-term investing using technical analysis. The biggest change, one of the big changes is, you know, everybody's mad that algos are skimming fractions of pennies off a trade. But you youngins, you want to make a trade, you can push a button, you get a report in a couple seconds. In the old days, if you wanted to make a trade, you had to pick up the phone, you call the broker, he sent something in, sent down to the floor, you got a report maybe 5 minutes later, maybe. So, and at that point, you had specialists, and they were skimming eighths and quarters and three-eighths off the trade. So the fraction of trading for instantaneous trading, I don't think is bad. And as far as the changing goes, I wrote a book, and I wrote back Bob Farrell an email, and I said, Bob, you got your 10 rules. They're legendary, but there are various copied forms of them floating on the internet. Could you send me your official version of your 10 rules? And by the way, do you have any more rules you'd like to add? Now, you all know his 10 rules. But I think his 11th rule, which nobody knows of because nobody bought my book, it holds up. Though business conditions may change, corporations and securities may change, and financial institutions and regulations may change, human nature remains essentially the same. And it's true. Think about it.
Well, thank you for that, Walter. Yeah, he kind of stole my thunder there because I was going to run right into the 10 rules of investing. Bob's not promotional in any way, shape, or form, so I'll do it for him. The 10 rules of investing have been downloaded 3.5 million times. So you can go out on your phone and increase those numbers immediately. 3.5
million. 305
million. Wait, is it 305? Oh, Jesus, I left out a couple of zeros. Wait, is it 305 million? What's the population
U.S.? Right. somebody must have done this.
Raise your hand if you've never downloaded those. Wow, look at that. All right, that number's going to go up pretty rapidly. You don't want to be one of the lone people in the population that hasn't downloaded that list yet. But I was looking at them today because we're in an interesting time in the market. I really enjoy talking about the stock market and talking about stocks. And, you know, I mean, clearly the favorite rule out of the 10 rules is bull markets are more fun than bear markets, right? I mean, that's an easy one. That should be at top of everybody's list. But there are other ones. I mean, today I heard Craig Johnson talk about how we have a market that's high level consolidation with bad breath. And one of the rules is markets are strongest when they are broad based and weakest when they are narrowed to a handful of blue chips. In this case, you could say today's Mag 7. We have a perspective on it. How negative is it? How worried are we about it? Walter, why don't you take this and then hand it over to Bob? How's that sound?
Yeah, back in the early 70s, the big fad was the Nifty 50 growth stocks, predictable growth stocks, and they were exploited like crazy. It got to the point where the Nifty 50 stocks, which were heavily weighted in the averages, were going up, but nothing else was. And when I moved into an independent retirement home, I had 49 loose leaf binders full of my memos, which I couldn't take with me. So I had them scanned. And Tony DeBell's family, when he passed, put all his memos up on a website. And I said, heck, I've already done the scanning. I've already got them. So I put them up. So if you go to DeemerMarketMemos.com, you can look at everything I wrote from the late 60s through 2016. And you can go back. The reason I mention this is you could go back to 1972 and 1973. Don't look at the verbiage. It's embarrassing. But there are a lot of charts in there. And you can see that the unweighted indicator digest average was going sideways all year, while the broad market averages were going up, and our growth averages were going up a lot. Mm-hmm. The reason I mention this is because right now we have 7 stocks that are going up, which we all know about. The Russell 2000 is not going up, which we all know about. And the problem I have in sleeping at night is 1972-73 did not end well. So I wonder to myself, I say, self, if the Russell 2000, if breath stays bad, if the bottom of the Russell 2000 can't participate, if all this big 7 stocks, are we replaying the Nifty 50 of the 1972-73 with the Mag 7? And as I say, the only reason that bothers me is it's only one example, but it didn't end well.
I'd like to add a little bit to that. I look at the market as having an alternating patterns. The world, as somebody was quoted as saying, is not linear, it's cyclical. One of the reasons why I believe that climate change is a big scam. But I feel that there is more than one example of this condition that has a concentration of money or in a few highly capitalized stocks where a bulk of stocks is not joining in the parade. It's not ended well. We had something similar in 1999. Most of the stocks that were more economically sensitive were not joining in the great internet party, and we did have a concentration there as well. And when we go back, even in the late 20s, there was some concentration, and there was a breadth divergence before the market peaked. And I think there have been three major decades where performance or return was well below average. Certainly the 1930s was one of those, and that was preceded by a divergence in speculative top and concentration in some of these big stocks like RCA. And the same thing happened in the Nifty 50. And all the institutions were the ones that were concentrating in the big stocks, which is true today. And we had had something similar in the following the Nifty 50. We had a decade of underperformance, about a 1% or 2% return average for the 10 years. And the other decade that had a low percentage or low performance percentage was the years after the internet boom in 2000 to 2009 or 2010. We put it together and it was minus 1% as an average return. So we're in a period now. Now those were maybe 30 years apart each, and you'd say, well, maybe the next time we have an underperformance decade is going to be 30 or 20 more years from now. But we've just come through a very high-performing decade, not as high as the 1990s, which was like 18% or 16%. It was closer to 14% in the last decade. And what people have learned, and this is another factor that fits into this, is that the way to make money is what worked in the last decade, which is you buy a fund that's invested in the averages, an ETF that's in the SPX and or SPYs, and you just hold it. And buy and hold and long-term investing is now well embedded into people's ideas of how to make money in the stock market. And of course it's right, because you look at any long-term history and stocks eventually go higher if you hold them long enough. And the problem is that through the market cycles, the time when you hear the most agreement about buy and hold is after the market's gone up a lot. And generally, that to me has been a sign of a top, meaning an approaching top. Because when we get markets that go parabolic, you just don't know how far they go before the return has to happen. Markets that go parabolic do not go sideways or correct by going sideways. So I'm looking at the decade that we have, that we're in now, as one in which we're more likely to have underperformance or lower than average, or that if you invest in the same manner that you invested in the last 10 years, you're not going to do well. And you may come out even. It may be that it's a low return and you hold the averages, but you won't make a big gain, as I see it. I think this, it may be that I'm too soon on that, and this decade is going to continue to look like it is now. But there is rising agreement that the economy is no longer going to have a recession, or if it is, it's a very mild recession or a soft landing. And the opinion of a year ago was so much different, where there was really the contrast between opinion that it's a soft landing or a hard landing. And that seems, the hard landing seems to be out of the question now. And one of these rules is that when all of the experts agree, you know something else is going to happen. So as I look at where we're positioned now, it seems to me that we would have to be concerned about this concentration, as Walter mentioned, and what it might mean with unless what is the other opinion that seems to be prevalent is that we will see value stocks outperform growth stocks in the next cycle. And that too seems to be due, but that would say that the stocks that are lagging, like in the Russell 2000 and value stocks in general, that are lagging, like I think as of the end of January, there were 53% of stocks in the S&P that are down on the year, even though we've had, you know, the new highs that are supported by a small, small number of stocks. And so as we look at the picture that's evolved here, it seems to me that the general idea that value is going to do well means that we should rotate from a concentrated market to a broad market again. Now, so far, history hasn't said that that's the way it happens. Now, you can say, okay, this time is different. And, you know, those are not the words you want to be quoted on. But I think from the standpoint of, you know, where we're going from here, it just seems to me you have to hope that this value game is replaced by a consolidation in the stocks that are up the most and the most concentrated money, and a return and breadth expanding. I have some doubts about it happening that way.
Can I just?
Bob mentioned a year ago that everybody was looking for a recession. I find it fascinating that the economists are going to have to revise all their leading economic indicators, and technicians aren't.
That's perfect. Tyler, how much time do we have?
15,
okay, because I definitely want to turn the audience loose and get some questions. I have a couple more, though. During our prep meeting, Walter, you mentioned something that John Templeton said. Mm-hmm. And it was referred, yeah, you did. It was referred here today that bull markets are born on, yeah. Correct? Bull markets are born on optimism, right?
Pessimism.
I'm born on pessimism. They grow on skepticism. They mature on optimism, and they die on euphoria. I remember somebody referred to it as well today, somebody in one of the sessions. Back there, you, John? Thank you, John. In one word, all right, so if we just take all of everything out of the conversation, the Mag 7, the broadness, one word, human nature, because this is a human nature conversation, that part right there. Where are we? Where are we in terms of how everybody was looking for recession? Now they're not looking for one.
Where are we?
Where are we what?
Where are we in this? Let's presuppose we're in a bull market. Let's presuppose we're in a bull market.
Okay, so presuppose we're in a bull market?
Correct.
Probably going to work. Bull markets usually go up.
Yeah, so we are in the skeptical phase, the acceptance phase, definitely not the euphoria phase, right?
Well, the Mag 7, you could probably make an argument that it's euphoric. Possibly.
Okay.
The Russell 2000, you could probably make an argument that it's in despair.
That's right.
It depends. Here, Tyler, are you around? I got a project for the CMT Association.
Yes, sir.
You know, the indexes that are around are all screwed up. The CMT Association ought to get together and create their own market index that works.
Just stocks that go up.
Just stocks that go up.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, I'm just curious because Bob Farrell did coin the term sentiment, and we talk a lot about sentiment. I'm not exactly sure how, you know, we can use it as well as we'd like. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around it. Where are we in terms of if this were a bull market? Let's say it's not a bull market. Is it, are people too optimistic for where we are? Are they not optimistic enough? Where? Because I don't sense euphoria. I did. Somebody did take a survey today, asked who was bullish, but I don't really like that question. I don't. I think the framing hurts the question. If I say something like, hey, how many of you think stocks are going to be higher a month from now? Raise your hand. Yeah, it's a very different than what I saw this morning where every hand went up, right? So how many of you, stocks are higher 3 months from now? 9 months from now? 5 years from now?
That looks a little bullish. But
it looks a little bullish.
But I think that the difficulty is the markets that we have today are at least bifurcated and maybe more. So when you talk about where sentiment is, sentiment with the concentrated investments in them have to me a higher or later stage in the cycle kind of sentiment toward them. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of other parts of the market, it varies day to day. It's like the market has no memory. One day you'll have a great big run up and the next day nothing happens. That's not true today, but yeah. It has happened many times in these markets. And I think they're the most frustrating markets because generalizations are much harder to make in markets that are so divided in what, how long various areas stay in favor. We'll have a run in some of the interest-sensitive stocks for a while, or we'll have a run in stocks that are in economically sensitive for a while, and then they'll fall by the wayside. So you can't say it's an overall high optimistic area. But I'll tell you one anecdotal thing. I played golf a few weeks ago, and the young man looked like he was about 20. Was cleaning my clubs. They do that after you finish each time you play. And he looked at my name and he said, "Oh, are you the Bob Farrell of the 20 rules?" And nobody has ever come up to me and that's not been in the investment business and said, "Are you the one that made up the 20 rules?" And I said, How do you know? I said, "I'm the most famous person that nobody ever heard of." And he said, "Well, my friends have told me that you play golf here." So it's an illustration that, like we've had a recent article in the Wall Street Journal, a couple of articles, one about the number of people who are now interested in the stock market has really grown. The individual investor is well invested in equities. Now, you can say we do have a lot of cash on the sidelines, and the real question is whether that comes off when it still has a return after 10 years of no return. And so I'm more inclined to think that there's more optimism outside, and that's it's a later stage of a cycle. And I think, well, the odds are supposed to favor the market being up in an election year, or if January is up, the market mm-hmm. should be up, and those kinds of things. But I think we have a problem this year. We have some tough things ahead of us, and I think this is a completely different environment from what we've been living through in, say, the last. The last generation, because this is a change, and I think we're going to have different rules.
Do you think politics trump technicals?
Well, nothing trumps technicals. I started. 25 years ago, when I gave a talk, I would always give a handout. You see, it's right under your seat there. But I'm kidding. But in my handout, starting in 1998, I quoted a study that was done in Scotland, and it was about the age of democracies and how long they last. And, you know, it pointed out that democracies don't live forever. And I'm sorry. And democracies not living forever means they go through a cycle. And a democracy lasts as long as the number of people who are drawing from the public treasury are not exceeding the number of people who contribute to it. And we have come to a point where there is a problem. We have a lot more people that, or we're gaining on that, a lot more people that are being supported by the government. And so there's other things, and I won't go into it because that's not technical analysis, but we brought up politics. Other part of that. I'm a member, and Walter is a member of the Silent Generation. The Silent Generation is the luckiest generation to have ever lived in this country, even though we were born in a depression. And the fact is that we were born at the bottom of a long-term cycle. And being born in that condition, our expectations on life and what lied ahead, particularly with World War II following that, were very low. And so we've gone through life being fooled by how good things are. And that cycle has continued with new technologies, new healthcare. The whole picture for us has been one expanding environment, and we've been surprised by how well we did. Now, you fast forward to the current Generation X and Z and since the 1990s, and the expectations there had evolved out of a boom period, so their expectations are high. Mm-hmm. And so when you're in a period where you have high expectations, how can you be fooled? Not by things being better, but by being worse. So expectations play a part in everything. And, you know, I'm a big people person. I feel that's one of the things that's going to be the hardest for AI to duplicate. But I do think that that's part of the problem here for me.
Well, thank you for that, Bob. Well, it sounds like the guy cleaning his clubs was one of that 350 million people, right? So it's like the odds weren't really that low, okay, Bob? And, you know, judging if Bob is, one of the original contrary opinion thinkers, so if we wanted to be just contrarian to the hand-raising, I'd say stocks are higher over the next month, low over the next 3 months, right? I would say that if I was contrarian, right? And I'm learning from the best here. Yeah. And then I would say, because all the hands went up for long term, below average returns for the decade.
Okay.
We did it.
Nice going.
All right. Why don't we open up the floor? Yes, please.
Yeah. I just want to add one thing. Well, I should. Bob and I are former presidents of the MTA, which is, and you know, that's tough to get. As soon as you get a group of technicians to agree with everything, somebody wants to be a contrarian. So it's a very tough organization to work. When I worked at Putnam, if any of you are from Harvard Business School, I apologize in advance. When I worked at Putnam, all the fundamental analysts came from the Harvard Business School. They were all like peas in a pod. They didn't know anything about the real world. So I perceived that one of my tasks in life was to teach them the facts of life. Fact number one is price is everything. They don't seasonally adjust it. They don't revise it. You know, it's a price. You may not agree with it, but that's what it is. And the second is a stock is not the same as a company. Now, had I worked for Warren Buffett, I would think differently, but I didn't. Okay. Now, here's it. I wrote a book called When the Time Comes to Buy, You Won't Want If you look it up on Amazon in the Kindle edition, you'll find that it says, take a look inside. The last three pages of that look inside give you an illustration of what I'm talking about, which is the McDonald's Corporation chart during the 1970s, one of the Nifty 50. And McDonald's earnings went up 25% per year, compounded throughout the 70s. Never missed a quarter. Okay. The company was great. The stock was cut in half. We owned the stock, not the company. So if you want to see this chart, don't have to buy the book. Just go on Amazon and take a free look. I think it's a classic example of how that, you know, I could tell you anything you want about any company you want about the next 5 years, and you can't tell me what the stock's going to do. The stock may go up, it may go up. You know, if I don't want to get into certain automobile companies.
You're a mess lot.
Well, thank you, Walter. Before we open up, I realized that I wanted to talk about one more thing, only because it's been referred to several times today, and I think it might be relevant. There's only been a couple of secular changes in interest rates. I think there's a feeling out there that this might be one of those, and I just wanted to get Bob and me and perhaps Walter, too, if we have time, their perspective on where we are in this interest rate cycle, because it's clearly important for the equity markets.
Well, interest rates have certainly been the mover of the market in recent times. I do believe in cycles, and I do believe in the fact that we have had two 40-year cycles, or two 40-year periods in the bond market that look like cycles that might repeat. And we had a bull market in bonds from the late 40s to the early 80s, and we had a bear market in bonds, maybe it's the opposite, in the period from 82 was a bear market. Now, that was the bear market was first, and then we just had a big bull market where we went from like 18% on the as the highest interest rate, and it went down below 1% on the 10-year anyway. And I think that that point where we went below 1% is the end of a 40-year cycle. So I believe that it makes sense to me, if I'm being William O'Neill and trying to bring a fundamental factor in, that we can make money as I think we can in the stock market, even if this is not a great decade, by having to use timing and more trading, more stock selection to make money. But I think in the bond market, the fact that we have a huge deficit of $34 trillion kind of makes it hard to believe that inflation is going to go down like it has in past cycles. And I actually believe that the next crisis that we have is more likely going to be in sovereign debt. And I don't believe that we're going to be able to pay off the debt that we have, which is what may keep inflation at a higher level over time, because you either inflate or you declare you don't pay it off, or you grow out of it. And under the current circumstances, it's going to be very difficult to grow out of it. So I think you'll make money in bonds, but I think it's I would look at it as you're going to have to do some timing in this this next few years. And meaning I think we're not going to see a one-way street in the new bull bond market.
Yeah.
Okay. Walter, you want to say anything?
I have nothing to add except the thought crossed my mind, Dean LeBaron's old definition of how you diversify a gold portfolio. You bury it in more than one backyard.
All right, that's great. I'm glad that Bob mentioned Bill O'Neill, I think, twice today. If you, for the young people or anybody in this room, if you haven't read How to Make Money in Stocks, it shaped the way I think about growth and momentum investing. It is a must read, period. Questions? Let's go. Should I walk the mic around?
You know what? Let me do that.
Yeah, I'm happy to do it.
That's what I'm here for. All right.
Go along. Kind of make them useful some way, yeah?
No, we don't have a mic.
Hey, it was a great talk, guys. Earlier you mentioned how, like, the rise of market maker volume and, you know, the new regimes of the market, new products that are coming in. Given that you guys were both presidents of the CMT Association, do you think that, like, the curriculum should be going in the direction of, like, you know, starting to look at these new products and kind of data that we can extract from them, whether it's, like, options trading volume and, you know, how that really comes into play in technicals? Because at least, like, when I finished the program a few years ago, like, what I got as a technician is that it's kind of just a way of looking at the lines and figuring out what the lines mean in terms of the price. And so, you know, I kind of like taking my data from everywhere, whether it's options or futures volume, and kind of using the same mindset as a technician and looking at overbought, oversold, and making sense of these new indicators and new data sets that might not have been around, you know, 6 years ago. So I guess my question is, like, do you think the curriculum should be adapting for this, or is it better to be fixed in the roots that it started at?
Okay, we need it.
Oh, boy. Yeah, he's bringing it.
Come on. This is giving you time to think about your answer.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, that is good. I mean, it's a valid, good question. When you don't have an answer to a question, you say, "Well, that's a good question," you know. But I think back to the 1960s, and you know, the individual investor was represented by the odd lot houses, because they and the odd lot houses were very big on the New York Stock Exchange, and as the institutionalization of the market occurred, and we got into that boom bust period, all the odd lot houses disappeared. And Merrill Lynch actually started or made an announcement, I think, in 1975 that they were not going to do the odd lot business or be represented on the floor in the odd lot business. So there was an indicator. We used to look at odd lot buy and sell figures to figure out what the sentiment was at the time. And so, you know, we now substituted that in general with the put-call ratios and at least for the daily and current data. But I think that we will, it might be a good idea to have something more in our curriculum. I don't know exactly how many. I never passed the test. But I think that there are other... I didn't take it either.
You could have led with that.
but anyway, I think there'll be new sources of data. Like what we did at Merrill Lynch was use our internal statistics, and other firms have done that now. So what we have to find is access to the data, and I'm not close enough to it now to tell you what places to look, but it's certainly something to investigate.
There's a lot of data out there. The question is what works and what doesn't. But, you know, there are a lot of people doing work on the put-call ratios, and there's a lot of debate going on of which ones work and which ones are messed up and things like that. Yeah, you got to teach old dogs new tricks. And I will say, too, This may embarrass me. Oh, I didn't take the CMT thing either. the reason why, don't get mad, Tyler.
No.
The reason why is that I had Metastock, and Metastock had a whole bunch of canned indicators. So I decided to try one out. Now I did the testing function, and it lost money. And I said, why should I learn this indicator that doesn't work? So I didn't take the test. But Zero Hedge, which is a controversial site, publishes some stuff from some of the big brokerage houses about what their flow of funds on their institutional desk are doing. I don't know how you quantify it, but there's probably some information there.
Tyler?
Oh, there you go.
All right. I apologize, everyone. I'm going to ask the last question, and then we're going to open up the bar, and you're going to all ask your questions directly. You started out today talking about Charlie put away those charts, and you guys probably have a long list of grievances with the institutional community that didn't really respect what we do. So if you'll indulge me for a second, I'm going to read to you a post online from the director of the CFA program. And this gentleman is in charge of all CFA testing worldwide and the creation of their curriculum. He just passed CMT level one. I won't tell you how many times he had to try. Says, Charter Market Technician Program, one down, two to go. Charting is Wall Street's oldest discipline. Forget the new kids on the block like ESG investing and quants. It even makes stalwarts such as macro of the 1980s and fundamentals of the 1930s look new. It was popularized by the first editor of the Wall Street Journal, Charles Dow, in the 1800s. With only 4,500 members versus CFA Institute's 200,000, a little flex, I'll give them that, a little flex, CMT Association is a small but elite club very much based in the financial capital of the world, and it is a legit discipline. He goes on to offer evidence about why he sees it as so legit. They just removed technical analysis from the CFA program. And he says that I started getting more interested in technical analysis when on podcast after podcast, it became clear that a surprising number of hedge fund portfolio managers are closet chartists. Perhaps the reason why Steve Cohen attended a recent CMT annual conference in New York. Hugh Hendry in London would use technical analysis as a source of idea generation, staring at hundreds of charts each week to look for breakouts, which would prompt him to dig in. If, as Ken French once taught me, the market is indeed 87% efficient, then surely breakouts could alert you to when someone has figured something out. He goes on and on and on, praising the knowledge that he gained by going through the program. Did you ever expect that the CFA or Wall Street would enjoy and understand and appreciate all of these things that you gentlemen innovated?
Did you say that they don't, the CFA just dropped technical analysis from theirs?
And they recommend all CFAs to go through the CMT.
Oh, all CFAs going to the CMT. Way to go.
Yeah, now we're talking.
Well, the most important thing in life is to have a discipline. So I'm not, I mean, it's lots of other things, but as far as this discussion is concerned, then I think that's what the CMT does for us. It teaches us how to think. Now, the one thing we have to also consider is that if everybody's doing the same thing, the efficiency level of the number of times when things are not doing exactly what they should do may multiply. But they will come back to the right direction, because if there's any skepticism that's generated out of that, then it comes back to what it should be. But I'm a professional skeptic, I have to say, not of this program. It's just of how we act as a group. If we're all doing the same thing, then we have to say there's going to be some blips in how things work out or interpreted. So we have to be alert to what's happening around us. And I think that's wonderful what's happening with the program. And I think it's been a great step up for us as a community and for the investment world. I mean, so we can have some good performance. And that's something that we're all striving for.
Honestly, you know, I'm kind of skeptical, though. I don't think technicians ever do the same thing. We got a breakaway momentum on January 12th. We got a couple other bread thrusts. I posted it on Twitter. Immediately, 20 people are telling me how stupid I am.
And on that note, listen, everybody, thank you so much. Bob, thank you. Walter, thank you. Really, really great stuff.
Thank you so much.
Fill the Gap is brought to you with support from Optima. In addition to candidate study of the official CMT curriculum, Optima provides a full video course on all of the material that candidates need to know for each level of the CMT exams. Each course is broken up into modules ranging from 15 to 45 minutes, depending on the complexity and length of the topics being covered. Learn more at Optima.com.